to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
And we have Shai Reshef, who I think, what was it, over a year ago, we met, and Shai was telling me about this amazing idea he had, and I was sort of, that's interesting, and knew that it would be interesting to many people here, combining both online education and collaboration, so it's great to have him here talking. Shai, as you'll see in our framing of this, is founder and president of the University of the People. Serves as a high-level advisor to the UN Global Alliance on Information and Communications Technologies, and spent over 15 years as chairman of the Kidum Group, the largest for-profit educational services company based in Israel. So thank you for coming to talk to us. We look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you for inviting me. The right for education, clear to everyone, is there and should be there for everyone. It's not a new thing. There is hardly anyone that would argue that it shouldn't be there. However, if we look at the situation at the world these days, and we look at the index of education, we see that if we take, we can divide the world into three categories, and as we all know, the situation in North America and in Western and actually Eastern Europe is much better than in the rest of the world. And if we look at Africa and if we look at East Asia, the situation is pretty poor. Many of the students or many of the kids do not have any education. The illiteracy is high. But if we go in closer and look at the access to higher education, the situation become very clear how bad the situation is and how worse it become. If we compare the situation in 1970 to today in North America to Africa, we see that 30% was the situation in 1970, it is 71% of the people have access now to higher education compared to Africa, where it was 1% and now it is 6%. So things are not getting better, they're getting worse. And most of the people worldwide, and if we look all the way to the right, most of the people worldwide do not have access to higher education. The reason for that is very clear. The main reason is that most of the people cannot afford going to higher education. Higher education is expensive in the US and worldwide. It's expensive to the point that the majority of the people cannot afford going to universities. And what goes with it is that government cannot afford building enough university to accommodate the need. So the situation is that in many places in the world, even if you have money, there aren't enough universities. So many people do not have money, but even if they have, in many cases, they cannot go into school because just there aren't enough universities. So in many cases, there are entrance exams. Certain percent of the people pass it, goes in, the rest left out with no other alternative. Another reason which is there for people not to attend university is geographical limitations. People live in the village, being accepted to a university, need to leave their family, move to the city, cannot afford doing it because they need to support their families. The poorer they are, that's more common. The situation is more common. And in many other places in the world, there are social issues. In some parts of the world, women tend not to go to colleges, and there are a lot of other reasons for people not to attend universities. We at the University of the People trying to change that. University of the People is the first ever non-profit, tuition-free online university designed to solve this problem, to enable people to attend college tuition free from wherever they are with whatever means they have to do that. First of all, we look at those people and we want to enable them to find a better job. We're looking at the majority of the people that do not have access to higher education, and it's clear that if they have an access, they will be able to improve their standard of living. So that's our main goal, to enable people to find a better job. They find a better job, they improve their standard of living, and as a result, their social status. We want this to happen to everyone, no matter where they are, no matter their background, no matter their gender, or any other social restrictions. We believe that by providing equal education, we will enable people to improve their standard of living, but by doing so, we help them, we help their families. The more people we have, we help their communities, their countries, and hopefully have an effect on the world. How do we do that? In order to enable people to study tuition-free, we grab everything that is available on the net and take it, use it free of charge. So we use open source technology, we use Moodle in order to teach our students. All of our courses are open source, and all the reading material for the students, our library is open source as well. We do not buy, we do not hold any IP, we do not buy any IP, and moreover, we do not store anything or prevent anyone from using anything. We also use peer-to-peer teaching or learning. We're trying to use what is developed, the new phenomena that has been developed the last year over the internet, of people willing to share and willing to help each other and bring it into the academia. So our studies is mainly by students teaching and learning from each other with instructors, our paid instructors, supervising them from the background. We heavily relying on volunteers. We have over 800 professors who jump on board to help us, and this is more than twice the number of students we have at this point. We'll talk about it in a second. We offer two programs. We offer business administration and computer science. The reason for that is very simple. As I mentioned before, we want to help people find a job, and these are the two most needed professions. They are the programs that are more likely that their graduate will find a job. This is one reason. The other reason is that these two programs are culturally neutral. So when you study computer science or business administration in the US, in China, in Nigeria, or in Indonesia, you basically study the same program. And it is important for us to bring people from all over the world together and study with each other. Therefore, we want only programs that are culturally, do not have any cultural bias. We announced the program January a year ago. We started admission last April, and we started teaching last September. We teach in terms of 10 weeks. Each term is 10 weeks long, and by now we are done, or actually tomorrow is the last day of our third term, and we start our fourth term Thursday this week. In the first three terms, we had 366 active students from 81 countries. The countries are from all over the world, Indonesia, US, China, Brazil, Vietnam, Nigeria, Saudi Arabia. 81 countries, as I said. Every continent has students, so we are very well spread all over the world. We have more male than female in our program, something that we hope that we will be able to change, but that's the distribution right now. And we have 144 students in computer science, more in business administration. I have to say that in computer science, the ratio of male-female is much worse than the ratio in business administration. That's actually the phenomena in all the computer science programs, but in our case, it's even more so. We have students from the age of 17 to 72. The average age is 33 years old. Yeah. We teach only in English. Not only that we teach in English, in order to be accepted, you have to demonstrate that your English is good enough, 500 in the TOEFL. In the future, we might offer other languages, but right now we teach only English. We're building a model, and we're building a model that we hope that universities and governments will embrace. The idea is to show universities that they can go much beyond their boundaries and teach many more people with a quality education, but more so for governments. Governments can spend a fraction of what they spend on traditional, on brick and mortar universities, and teach everyone. So what we're showing is, or we're showing a model where everyone can be taught with a decent, high-quality education in a very inexpensive way. Just to end up with something that I'm happy to share with you, we ask the students, we have a weekly feedback, and twice a term, we ask them in-depth. We have an in-depth survey, and we have a lot of questions, but the one that for me summarizes everything is the question of, would you recommend University of the People to your peers? 91% say yes. So I guess that we're doing a decent job. And that was my introduction to the topic, and from here, it's up to you to ask. Yeah.
I'm looking at your course calendar right now. It looks like you have a third division called General Studies. Can you say a little bit about what that is?
Yeah. We build a regular American, it's a regular American program, and in every American program, in addition to the subject matter, about a third of the studies is General Studies. So we do have General Studies, and the General Studies is General Studies about different lines of professions.
What is your business model?
Thank you for asking. I should have said it. No, you're right. Okay, so we are tuition free, but we are not free. Right now we are free all together, and students pay nothing whatsoever. But in the future, students will pay for two things. Every time they enroll, they will pay application processing fee that will range from $15 to $50, depending on the country that they're coming from. The poorer the country, the less they will pay. And every time they take a course, they have to pay for assessment processing fee that will range between $10 to $100, again, depending on the country they're coming from. To make it clear, a student from a poor country, if he doesn't get any help, any scholarship, any support, will have to pay about $400 for the entire duration of the program, for the 4 to 6 years for the entire degree. A student from a rich country, again, or wealthy country, will have to pay about $4,000 for the entire program. This amount that we charge the students will make us sustainable when we have 15,000 students, and that's basically our business model.
Is it for-profit?
It's non-profit. It's non-profit, but the idea is that it will be sustainable having 15 students and more.
I have two very separate questions, so I'll just ask both of them right off. The first one was about the Global Education Index that you quoted, and whether or not that statistic on Africa around 6% having access to higher education was out of the percentage of students in Africa that are have sufficient education to go to higher education?
No. My understanding is that it's 6% of the total relevant population aid in the right age. Yeah.
Okay. I was just curious about that. And the other one was about the open source curriculum and open source technology is not open access the way that I looked at your website. And so I was just wondering, you know, because everything's behind the application paywall, if there's any intention in the future to make your syllabi open access.
Definitely, yes. What we do, we take, right now our courses are being written by volunteering professors or for the different courses that we offer. And the idea is that everything that they give us will bring back and we'll make it open. It's not open right now because we are at the running stage. We want to make sure that the courses are in good quality and we don't need to make any more changes or at least don't need to make major changes before we put them back. But the answer is yes, all of our courses will be open online for anyone to use. Yes.
Hi, I'm Andrew Maliazzi. We've spoken on the phone before. I do finalsclub.org, the nonprofit open education site. And when we talked the last time, we were discussing the accreditation process for University of the People. And I wonder how that's advanced or what new news you might have about getting official accreditation for the university.
Well, we are registered as an American university, and the U.S. accreditation process is quite a lengthy process, and you cannot even apply for accreditation before you are up and running for a while. It is our intention to apply for accreditation. We're trying to do our best that our quality would be good enough, so we will get accreditation in due time. The only thing I can say is that right now we are not accredited, but we get tremendous support from the academia. I just mentioned that we have 800 volunteering professors. Our provost came from Colombia. The two department deans are from NYU. We are research partner of Yale Law School. We are supported by the UN. So we have we are being hugged by a lot of good academic institution, which I guess means that we are not bad, but we do not have accreditation right now. Yeah. Yes, please.
How do you resolve copyright issues? We understand that program is heavily relying on open source programs. However, there might arise some copyright issues in producing or distributing certain materials for the review of students. And also in relation to the peer-to-peer discussions, it has often been the case that the students sometimes post certain copyrighted materials on the web for the review of other peer groups. It sometimes happens. So I'm not sure if you have experienced the same problems, but have you ever reviewed that kind of potential issues?
Well, we're working with Creative Commons license, and we don't use anything that we don't have the license and that we are not allowed to use and we are not allowed to distribute to our students. In some cases, before using a textbook or material, we contact the owner of the IP and ask his permission. So we ourselves are not using anything that we don't have the right to use. So this is, I think that this answers this part of the question. In terms of students, the first two courses that they take, one of them is English and the other one is a computer skills. And basically in the computer one, we teach them what they're allowed to do, what they're not allowed to do, how to use copyrights, what they're allowed to put and what they're not allowed, and what kind of usage we expect them to do. We try to keep it as much as we can. You know, we are not. We're doing our best to make sure that we don't violate any copyright laws, and our students as well. But if you ask me whether I'm sure that any student never put anything that he was not supposed to, I cannot say that.
Well, since the raison d'être of this online university is accessibility, right? Is universal accessibility. Wouldn't it make sense to make the acquisition of basic English or English at the level of the TOEFL that you mentioned an integral part, like a first stepping stone, either to team up with another online free source or to offer your own English programs from scratch? Otherwise, you're reaching only people who have a fairly high competency in English, and that's not every student you're trying to reach.
Well, let's make your question even more by asking why we, in order to be accepted to the university, you need to show us high school diploma, and we verify that you have that the high school diploma is valid from a recognized institution, that you are the right student to graduate, and everything that you gave us is original or is notarized. And the question can come, why do we ask that as well? And you're right. In terms of our ideology, anyone can start. Why not? Let anyone start, and if they can make it, they will continue. If they cannot, they will drop out. The thing is that we are working for accreditation, and in order to be accredited, we must verify that they have high school diploma and that their English is good enough. Now, yes, it might make sense to offer some students remedial and English to make sure that their English is good enough before they are accepted. Well, we don't do it. Maybe we will do it in the future, but you know, there is as much as you can do. We don't offer high school level studies as well. So that's what we decided, that that's the niche that we use. Yes.
Sponsors, financial sponsors, or just out of curiosity, if you can share that.
I can share that. It's myself so far. So I put $1 million into the program, and now I'm looking for sponsors. By the way, I'm here if anyone, and I have place for checks here. So, it's me, and we're looking for to raise, looking for more support. Yeah.
And the quick follow up is, perhaps you already mentioned it, but is there a deadline? Is there like a cycle where students, you know, have to apply, or is it ongoing where somebody decides, oh, I want to do this, and they apply now, or and then
it's ongoing. We start a term every 10 weeks, every 2.5 months, around 2.5 months, and yeah. Next in Thursday this week we have a new intake. So every 2.5 weeks we have a new intake.
Process to be accepted to beginning. What's that cycle?
The process is students have to fill up an online application, which takes some time, but it's relatively a short process. And then they need to send us their high school diploma and a few documents. They need physically to send them to us. And even that, it's things that hopefully we will be able to. Not to ask in the future, but right now they have to ask to our headquarters in Pasadena the original documents, and from then the question is how long take the, usually the process take between a month to a month and a half to a student, but it depends how long it takes the students. You know, we have a lot of stories. We have refugees. Well, how do they get their original high school diploma? So there are a lot of issues, and there are a lot of people that have a hard time finding the document, sending the document. So sometimes it takes longer, but usually it shouldn't take more than a month or a month and a half, and they get answer right away.
So all of the questions up till now had to do with the social mission or the business model or the structure, and I don't want to cut those off, and I think we should go back. But if you could spend a few minutes on a different aspect of it, which is the educational technology and collaboration side. Whether you could spend a few minutes walking us through what makes for a classroom, what makes for one of these volunteer professors, mentors, peers, what's the shape of a class?
Okay.
In your space? I think it would be, and again, then we should go back to whatever it is that ends up pulling people, but that's something that you mentioned, and that I think there are a lot of people who are interested in that particular side as well, that would be useful to hear just an initial walkthrough, and then we can come
Thanks.
Back to the questions.
When student take a class, he's being placed together with 20 other students from all over the world that study with him. Each course take 10 weeks, 8 weeks of studies and 2 weeks for studying for the exam and taking the exam. Each week, each course is divided, as I said, 2 weeks. Each week starts on Thursday, ends on Wednesday. Between the week, they have all the freedom, but there is, it's blocks of weeks. Within a week, a student get into the classroom and find the lecture of the week, the reading assignment of the week, the homework assignment of the week, and a discussion question. The discussion question is the core of our learning paradigm. After reading the material, each student must post in the class his original comment, his original contribution to the discussion point. After he posts his comment, he's able to see what the other students post. And then they start talking between themselves about the discussion topic of the week. A student must, as I said, post his own discussion point and talk to the other students or discuss with the other students at least 4 times a week. So students start talking to each other. So let's say nothing is it's not synchronous, and nothing is neither live or require a broadband. In order to enable students from all over the world to study with us, in order to enable students who don't even own computer but study with in internet cafe, and we have some cases like this, and to save them time and money and bandwidth, we don't use neither audio or video. Everything is text-based. And as I said, after reading the material, they start discussing between themselves. If they don't discuss between themselves, they fail. That's our way to measure their participation in the classroom. They must participate in the class. By the way, usually they participate much more than they are required. They do it at their own time. Students can, it's just for those who are not familiar with the Moodle system, it's very, very similar to what we use to, well, like forms. It's very similar to forms where you get, when you log in, you see the discussion and you see everything that has happened there or happened from day one until now. So every student can log on anytime he wants, see what's going on, put his own discussion point, leave the classroom, come the day after and see what other students had to say about what he said or anything that developed within the classroom, and continue. If a student has a question, he doesn't understand something, he wants to elaborate on any topic that is not part of the discussion but is relevant to the course, he can leave the classroom and go to the course form. In the course form, he will find all the university students together with our instructor, our paid instructors, and he can discuss any topic he wants. He can elaborate on any question. We are now in a stage of developing a social network, which will be our own social network, the university social network, that will be the place where all of our students can interact on any topic they want, be it academic or social. And that's the place where we will enable our volunteers to come and interact with our students on any topic they want. So that's basically the system. Now, they study every week. By the end of the week, they take a quiz. The quiz is not graded. It's for them to see that they master the material. They hand in their homework, go to the next week. Students get graded over their participation in the classroom, over their homework assignment, and by the end of the course, they take an exam, they need to pass it, then they get their grade and move on. Our instructors, our paid instructors, and we do have instructors, they look from the outside, see what's going on in the classroom, help the students if they have questions, intervene if they feel that there is a need to intervene, and supervise all the grading system to make sure that the students get the grade that they should get. Is that okay?
I wonder if you, when you're talking about the discussion forums are familiar with a particular tool that came out of this building, actually. I believe Jonathan Citrine was responsible, and others as well, but it's a rotisserie discussion forum. Rather than a linear forum, everyone posts, and instead of getting everyone's responses, you only get a single person's response and are then tasked with the opportunity to give a thoughtful response of your own to that person. And what it does is it creates these nice, interesting threads where you're getting much more thoughtful conversation rather than sort of the haphazardness of just a linear discussion board. You might want to check it out. The code for it is on the H2O site, if I'm not mistaken. I can tell you a little bit more about it. I've played with it myself.
Okay.
But it's cool, and it's exceptionally good for academic discussion.
Yes.
Seems like one of the biggest challenges in higher education is keeping enrolled students enrolled, retention. It's impressive all the things you do on a weekly basis to monitor the progress of the students, but what has your experience been thus far, and what are your infrastructural supports for keeping the students involved over the course of terms so that they actually complete the entire program?
Like many other things, it's work in progress. I would say that dropout is the major issue of all the online universities. We're talking about tens, I'm talking about percentage of students dropping the first week, the first course, and et cetera, et cetera. So far, we are positively surprised. And I think it is because, and we get it every day from students who come and say, that was my lifetime chance, you saved my life, it's wishful it was a wishful thinking for me. So I think that the kind of students that we get have much higher motivation than regular online students. But, you know, I should say two things. First of all, we are at the very beginning. We don't have a long enough history to say what will be the situation. Second, even those that drop out with us right now, we enable them 2 semesters to come back. So I should say that we have a very high level of satisfaction, but we do have drop out, and I'm unable to give numbers right now. Not only that, it's an issue, we will have to develop, and we're thinking about it, the right tools or the right means to help students stay online, because it is an issue and everyone faces it, and we are not going to avoid it.
2 questions. What do you know of how people are finding you? And secondly, once people get into the system, what are the maximum and minimum sizes of classes, and how is that determined?
Okay, I'll start with the second one, 20 students in each class. That's the number, but if we have one course that we have 35 students, so it's not 20, but so it's 17, 80. But we close the classroom usually by 20, that's the number. It's a very interesting question, because students find us first of all, through the media. Since we announced the program, we got tremendous coverage. We had over 1,000 articles written about us all over the world. And that's how students find us. The second thing is social networks. We're trying to push our presence in social networks. We are very short on budget, so it's not that we're spending a lot of money, but we have 25,000, well, I think that right now, I don't know, it wasn't there before the lecture, but probably by now we have 25,000 fans on Facebook, so we're getting momentum. That's, I think, is a quite impressive number. And the third is from their peers, their friends. Saying all that, I think that we have issue there. It's something that it should have, but it hasn't crossed my mind when we announced the program. But, you know, if the New York Times write about us, it's great. We're very proud of ourselves to be in the New York Times. Well, our potential students probably don't read the New York Times. So getting to the right
students, the right, those that we really, that's a challenge. And since our marketing budget is very limited, we are not there yet. It will be something that we have to deal. We hope that when we raise money, we will be able to build marketing channels to reach these people that are not, do not read newspaper, are not on the net, but still can and should study with us. Yes.
I was going to ask a question, but it feeds in with what you said. I was wondering how, what your vision was as people start asking lots and lots of questions dynamically. How do you keep that from being overwhelming, like we've all found with email and the old news groups? At the beginning, you read everything, but you can't possibly read everything. But maybe that's linked to the fact that your classes are 20. I mean, I hadn't thought you would have small classes. That means there's one
20 teacher. 20 is quite a lot for online, by the way. Usually it's less than that, for that very reason, because of the intensity and because students read. We don't have this problem right now, but in the past I was involved in a different online university, and there we punished students for over-participation.
because
what happened is, when you think about it, it sounds great. People are very active. But then by the end of the course, they drop out because they said, you know, it's too much time. I can't afford it. So they spend too much time. It become very intensive. They enjoyed it a lot. But then they realize that it's too much for them. But we haven't encountered so far. So
you have one teacher then monitoring them?
Right now, we try the teachers to be involved only if they have to. We try that they will not be. They are very involved right now, but we're trying to push them to be, because the model is that in the long run, we believe that we will not have a lot of instructors involved in the classroom. It should be more peer-to-peer, and they will be taught how to use the system and how to participate and how the peer-to-peer should function rather than using the instructors.
To go to the UN, since you have a relationship with the UN, to go to the country offices like UNFPA, UNESCO, the different, because they've actually done lots of program marketing, which would be one idea to reach out, since it's 15 to 24, 25, that age range. And then I wonder, is it possible for those, the dropout issue, to do some sort of pilot project where you have live tutors at the university or wherever that the students in these countries can actually go to, because sometimes online can be intimidating for students, and they might, it's a pilot idea, perhaps.
Maybe. I think
somebody live they can actually talk with about.
Online or
no,
face to face?
Face to face. What?
We'll give you the names of all the students that drop out. Go talk to them. Do it. I don't think that we will be able to do it. But it's not a bad idea, obviously.
Two brief things. One, there is something, the name is similar to yours. It's called Université Populaire, the popular, the people's university. It started in France. There's a branch here in Cambridge, actually, that does weekly or biweekly sessions, one at MIT and one at the International School of Boston, in French. On things like environment, there's one this week on the environment, geopolitics,
what's the age range?
Anybody can come. Totally open, totally free. Anyone can come. Each kind of lecture presentation followed by as long a discussion, all in French. Totally open, totally free. So that obviously reaching, in each case, a small group of 20, 30, 40 people. Secondly, my son Dan teaches at Berklee College of Music here in Boston, and he has designed and teaches two online courses, but which include a 1 hour a week chat, but text chat. So students 1 hour a week, they know that they can he'll be online, and any students who want to can pop in and ask questions, query one another, or query him about things. Would that be an option for your courses?
Live
available,
chat,
so to speak, a live chat, but not speaking, just text.
It is an option. The question, and every time we puzzle, how much do we want to make the course richer? Because when you make it richer and to have live chat means that some people cannot do it. So how do you, on the one hand, not discriminate them, on the other hand, not discriminate, not punishing those who can have richer programs, not to have, and we try to balance. Right now, when we have the reading assignment, for example, we send them to look at courses, online, other universities' courses that are online, video, but it's never mandatory. It's like supplementary. So, you know, if you can do it, great. If not, it's not mandatory. Yes?
Three separate questions. Are you incorporated anywhere? And also, where is your physical infrastructure? Is there anything like that? And, also, on a different note, just do any of your students have security type issues, like women in Afghanistan or something, who might not want to be open about being in the university?
We are incorporated in Pasadena. We are a non-profit organization. We are registered share there as a non-share company. This is one. Second, we have headquarters in Pasadena. We have a lot of people helping us in New York. We have an office in Tel Aviv, and we are thinking of opening an academic office in India and probably in one more developed country. So the idea is that as an international university, will be operated from many parts of the world. Security, I don't know. First, because if they can't study with us, we don't know, and those who study with us don't tell us. We do know that we have very few women from the Middle East. But, you know, there are less women in the Middle East universities, and we haven't broke this, I don't know how to call it, this behavior. But I don't know if the reason is security. At least I'm not aware of it.
Well, this is, again, I'm contextualizing this you know, rather noble enterprise. I had experience 20 years ago of the extreme democratization of access to higher education in Northern European countries, which resulted in a lot of very qualified, very specialized people being produced by the educational system who didn't find jobs. So that creates its own source of frustrations and social problems. And of course, at a different level, you might be dealing with that too. You can train a lot of computer or business savvy people, but if the infrastructure can't absorb them, what happens? Or is that not in your purview at all?
I think that, you know, computer scientists do not need, can be anywhere and work with remotely with companies all over the world. We believe that that's the best professions. Now, you know, it's like in any other, it's supply and demand. If we train them in professions that they don't find a job, the next students will probably choose different programs, and we will offer different programs. So, but yes.
I was curious actually about the connection you have with the UN, because I saw that come up on your most recent news feed. How has that changed the dynamics? Were you going for that kind of formal connection with the UN at all when you started the organization? And I'm just curious about that trajectory from here forward.
Well, the UN approached us after we started running, and I'm an advisor of UN Guide, which is a global alliance of ICT and development, that's the right title. I lectured in one of their conferences, and I think that the UN helped us in two major ways. First, legitimacy. I think that a lot of people, especially in the third world, respect dramatically. The UN is very respected in many parts of the world, and be associated with the UN helps us a lot. Second, we have the same mission. The mission of UN Guide is to bring technology into the third world, the usage of technology into the third world. Well, that's exactly what we're doing. So we work together, and we work with a few people that are involved with the UN to promote the program and spread it.
One piece of marketing advice, if you're a nonprofit, Google actually has a program where they'll give you up to $10,000 a month in free AdWords credits. So I would highly encourage you to apply if you haven't.
And two, one of the things that happens in real universities that strongly promotes the culture and gets buy-in from students in and out of the physical place are extracurricular activities, sports, music, things like that. I wonder, and this is a crazy idea that just popped into my head, but what you might be doing to encourage the socializing of your students outside of an academic setting. And one idea popped into my head, maybe you could have a University of the People World of Warcraft team or something that you could deploy to, you know, get these people to not only think and work together, but also to play together. I think it's important for academics as well.
I think that you're right that part of the education, the American education, is the social life. And I've been asked a lot whether they don't miss something by studying it fully online. Yeah. I don't think that the question is whether they choose it, whether they prefer it or not. It's not a question of preference. It's either that or nothing. So for most of our students is either they study with us or they don't study at all. Yeah, maybe they miss something. Well, they get much more than they miss. I would say something else. 4 million students study in the U.S. right now online. Students take at least one course online. The Department of Education published a mega study, I think about 2 months ago, that says that the best method of teaching is hybrid of online and offline. After that, online. And then third comes the offline. So online is preferred. Oh, surprise, surprise, huh? So I think that one thing that should we should bear in mind that when you do study like this, you ask the students who study online. Well, the students who study online probably chose to study online. They were not my students. So it's people who study online is not easy. It's hard. It's much harder than studying a traditional classroom where you have a professor, they talk, you listen, you write, you go home. That's it. It's very interactive, very demanding, a lot of self-discipline. You can't study without self-discipline. So it's quite tough, but it's very effective. But you miss some. We're trying, that's the reason we're now building this social network for them, and they can do whatever they want. You know, they can take your idea, they can, you know, they can open a virtual bar there and go for a drink every other day. So, yeah. Yes.
Well, a couple of things. You're requiring primary documents for the high school equivalency.
Right.
And one of the reasons you might not be getting women from some parts of the world is that those women do not have access to public education that would give them a certificate for high school. Have you considered doing something like international baccalaureate or GED testing or something like that associated with your program to get those people who have learned privately to the point of, you know, because if you want to get gender equity in those areas, you're going to have something like that.
I would love that someone would do that, and I'll take the students. There are as much as we can do. We should decide what we can and what we cannot.
But even if you had links to programs that did that, it would give people a hope that they could get admission, even if they had to go to another agency to get the certification online.
Right.
You know, and that might open it up to more people.
I'm sure it will develop.
Yeah, I know. You can't do everything. You've done a lot, you know, with what you with the resources you've got. I'm very impressed. How do you certify instructors?
All of our instructors have previous experience as teachers, and they are either MA or PhDs, so they come with the experience, and we instruct them how to teach online because our way of teaching is different. So,
and are you looking at engaging like people to write grants for the university, or are you just looking for commercial sponsorship?
We're looking for people to write grants.
Yeah. Okay, we'll talk afterwards.
Sure, we will.
Yeah. It is exciting. How big do you think this could? Yeah, how scalable? Given the way that you operate with, you know, the volunteers and the mentors, and the, could it be 100,000, a million?
Yes.
2 million?
Yes. Yes.
All of that? You think it's scalable that way?
First of all, it's very scalable. And I don't see any upper limit. The limit will be when we won't have enough, when we don't have more students. Mm-hmm. There is no reason. You know, there are today already the university, the Indira Gandhi University, that has 2 million students. A University of Phoenix has 500,000 students. So there are huge, and they are fully online. There are quite a few big universities, and there is no reason that we won't be able. Again, I think that volunteers is something that is a little bit misleading. I think that I should make it clear. We use the volunteers as much as we can. We love having volunteers, but we don't rely on the volunteers. We will never be in a situation that if volunteer decide one day that he has other things to do, the organization stop functioning. So whenever we have volunteer, we have backup with our own staff to make sure that if the volunteer do not deliver, we have our own people to deliver. But the volunteer enable us to go very, very wide and very big, because most of them do deliver what they promise to deliver. So, yeah.
This is another thought / suggestion that's kind of out there, but in regards to retention being a problem, particularly in an online environment, one of the developments in social software outside of education has been the introduction of gaming elements into traditionally non-gaming systems. Have you considered the possibility of adding certain gaming, leveling, advancing, ranking, competitive elements that would perhaps incentivize and encourage people to get more involved in the process of learning?
We haven't so far. And again, the reason is that right now we want to make sure that it works, that it functions, that we get to the masses, give them great education, and it works. We might. We might in the future, because the bigger... Yeah, the bigger you are, and the more problems you solve and things work, you can let yourself look at other things. And yeah, we might.
And perhaps because I'm not as familiar with online learning, is there going to be a problem with assessment in terms of you're actually having to see the physical person? My experience has been teaching in real classrooms, and that certainly is a problem with people trying to sneak around. As you become more successful and people are interested in the certificate and not necessarily the learning, then...
I'm very happy with this comment, because usually people feel that only online there is a problem. Offline, everything is perfect.
Yeah, well.
And it is true, because education is built on trust. Let's remember that someone handing a PhD, how do you know that he wrote the PhD, right? So we think that we know, but what we do, there are today quite a few ways to examine people and check that it's them. Second, students know very well each other. So it's really hard, you know, the students know each other, and they are the best way to make sure that the students are the real students and they do the right job. But I would say also that as part of the program, they will be required to take proctored exams as well. So they will come to a place where someone will identify them and supervise the test, and this test would be mandatory. You can't get the degree without doing it. So that's it will be a combination of different mechanisms.
You were talking about scaling, and actually, you know, school is one of the places where the network effect holds best, right? The larger it gets, the more mind share, and the better it is for everyone. And I think the same would hold for your program. But it makes me think of the early days of the internet, when the purpose was to network universities together, have them be able to share research and information. And I wonder if you've given any thought to not only trying to recruit students from the third world, but also get the buy-in from other schools, places like Harvard and Yale and Columbia and MIT, and get people to contribute to the discussion forums, again, in that sort of volunteer capacity where they're both teaching and learning with your community of students, so that we can make a more robust learning environment for everyone. I wonder what your thoughts are.
Yes. First of all, the courses that we use courses that are being written by professors that are from those universities and others. And we send our students to read material there and to see lectures there and to see courses there. Also, we are, as I mentioned, we are a research partner with Yale Law School, but also we're looking now to develop a program where students, hopefully graduate students from great universities, will come and be more mentors of our students. So the exchange between them, I think, will have great benefit to our students, and yeah, that's something that we're working on. So, yeah.
I noticed that it looked like in your study process there was a large emphasis on peer assessment, that is basically people sort of looking at each other's work.
Right.
Can you say more about how that works?
Yeah, sure. First of all, by the end of students grade each other on their participation, the quality of their contribution into the discussion. So this is one thing. Second, every homework assignment is being distributed to students who check it and give grades to the other students. So students really...
Anonymously?
Yeah. Yeah, they don't know who... Neither know who. Now, but we have a system to check it, so if there is the difference between the grades or more than one grade, the instructor intervene.
So you have more than one student grade each other student.
Sure. And students can complain, because if they feel that the grade that their peer gave them is not good enough, it goes to the instructor to regrade it and to determine what's the right grade for the student. But students are very active. They're very active in, they have code of conduct, and students are very, it's, you know, in a way we try to build it in, I think, somewhat to resemble the internet behavior, the social networking behavior, that if you do something wrong, people will push you right away and come and say, that's not the way to do it. So, and it works. I think the student, one of the main complaints that we have right now is that they create really a bond between themselves, the student. So if they take the first course together and the second one, they're with different students, they don't have contact with the other students because our social network is not there. And we have a very strong demand for this social network. By the way, I've just heard that there is a petition of our students to start, and we're definitely working on that. Because they feel the network that they build between themselves, the bond of the working together, they have the same mission with themselves and with us, because they definitely feel that they appreciate what we do. They are very easy with us when things do not work as well as they should, and this happened also. So altogether, it's like a kind of a friendly environment between the students and the university.
I wonder if you've thought of doing a white label version for, say, a country or some other sponsoring organization? Down the road.
I would love to. I mean, I was asked more than once, aren't you afraid that someone will steal the idea? And my answer is, please, take it. Just do it. And if there will be, I can guarantee that if there will be a government or any big institution that will come and say, I want to take it and do it for my country, I will be the first one to jump and help them to do it. Yeah, that's why we're there. So, yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.